Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm Joan Michelson. We are talking innovation with top leaders and thinkers in energy and sustainability, and those who are transforming our world. You benefit from my extensive network of C-level executives, entrepreneurs, authors, artists, government leaders, and journalists, and my many years in the media and Fortune 500 companies. Find us online on greenconnectionsradio.com, iTunes, iHeartRadio, where we come to you from today. Tune in, Stitcher, and wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts. I keep finding it in odd little places all over the web. So thank you to iHeartRadio for letting us use their studio. It's a terrific spot. Clean energy technologies are evolving at a record-breaking pace. Most of us in this world really know that. And they're growing at such a quick pace that they're becoming cost-compatible with fossil fuels. Even coal, long regarded as the cheapest fuel per kilowatt-hour, is being dwarfed in some cases by renewable energy prices, I'm hearing, with some renewable energy prices having gone as low as 2.5 cents per kilowatt-hour, I think, and I'm sure our guest will correct me if that's wrong. Wind represents 47% of new power generation in the U.S. That's amazing. And other countries are expanding at the same or faster rate as well. On top of that, we're well on our way to developing a so-called smart grid that will increase our resilience and consistency of power, as well as reduce our vulnerability to cybersecurity threats and natural disasters. But a linchpin in all of this is storage. We must, emphasize must, be able to store solar and wind energy in particular in order to evolve our energy and power systems to the next level, especially to get off of fossil fuels. We have to address the renewable energy issues with being available intermittently. That is, the wind does not always blow and the sun does not always shine. So what do we do in between to spread out the service needs? What is the state of storage today, then, to fill this gap? And when will these challenges with storage be maybe a thing of the past? And we'll have it all handled and we'll look back affectionately on the days we didn't know what to do. Today, we have the perfect person to talk to about this. Dr. Kimberly McGrath has spent her entire career in the development and commercialization of various types of energy storage, including battery, fuel cell, and ultracapacitor energy storage. Today, she is Director of Business Development for Maxwell Technologies. And yes, she is a doctor. She received her doctorate in chemistry from the University of Southern California and her MBA from the University of California at Irvine. So as a fellow UC alum, I say, welcome to Green Connections Radio, Kimberly, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Joan. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you're welcome. You're welcome. So did I get any of my facts wrong in my intro?
Yeah, no, I think it's a great intro to frame this discussion. It's perfect timing to have this discussion as well, given how much the landscape of not only renewable energy deployments, but storage is changing and growing.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. That's why we really wanted to have you on. So for our listeners that do not have a PhD in chemistry, can you explain how storage actually does work?
Okay, so the simplest description of storage and how it's going to bring value to the grid is that storage enables you to have energy and power when and where you need it, right? You can imagine, just as you said perfectly, the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. So what happens when that doesn't happen, right? If we can capture the excess energy generated during times when we have amazing sunshine and amazing wind and keep that energy for those periods where it's not present, there's certain value to that, right? So storage essentially enables us to have that energy on demand when we actually need it. So, in the evening times, we've got all of our appliances running and we need energy to operate those appliances. And, that's a perfect time of day when the sun isn't out. So what are we going to do? Storage can take that that excess energy and we can use it when we need it at nighttime. So that's a simple description of the benefit of storage, say for the average consumer of electricity.
Perfect. That's terrific. So what do you see as the most promising in battery technologies? I mean, we hear about lithium ion batteries. We all hear about electric cars, which we'll talk about a little bit in a minute. But, you know, you're in the driver's seat. You're in the nexus, if you will, of hearing about all these cool technologies and even developing some of them. So what do you see as the some of the most promising?
Yeah, so this is an absolutely fascinating topic, and it really has to do with capturing the most amount of value out of an energy storage system. So you've mentioned a few technologies, you know, batteries being one of the key technologies. There's, of course, ultracapacitors, which is what Maxwell develops, as well as many other types of storage technologies. And the most fascinating piece is, you know, given that we have all of these quote-unquote different technologies in our toolbox, how can we combine them together in an energy storage system to provide the most value? So I think, you know, the hottest area really is the optimization of these technologies working together to be the most efficient at delivering power and energy to people. So, you know, we have all of these different types of chemistries in the batteries. And like I said, we have flywheels, ultracapacitors, a myriad of different technologies, and they're all good at different things, so to speak, within energy storage. You take, for example, a lithium ion battery, even a flow battery. Those batteries are very good at storing hours worth of energy, which is great when you have, you know, say a lot of excess generation from renewables and you need that energy capacity. What some of those batteries aren't so good at is delivering power very quickly. And that's where a technology like an ultracapacitor comes into play. Ultracapacitors do not store hours worth of energy, but they can respond very quickly to changes, which is critical when you start to think about renewables.
So wait a second. So first of all, explain what an ultracapacitor is, but I'm fascinated by this idea of combining ways to do energy storage so that you optimize them, that in effect, the whole is better than the sum of the parts.
So yes, the synergies there. So I'll back up a second and give you a brief overview of an ultracapacitor and perhaps why that technology is different from some of the batteries that people may be more familiar with. So an ultracapacitor is an electrostatic device, meaning it does not rely on chemical reactions, so to speak, to operate. It is purely operated in an electric field. And what that enables it to do is move charge around a lot faster. So that's where we get these high power, fast responding characteristics out of an ultracapacitor versus a battery. Some of the other key features or differences between the technologies is when we talk about ultracapacitors, we talk about hundreds of thousands, if not millions of cycles, simply because the device does not have the same chemical degradation mechanisms that a battery does.
And a cycle is charging it and then going through the charge is one cycle, right?
Yeah.
It's like going up a flight of stairs
and then discharging it.
Okay, go
ahead. That's one cycle. And typically these devices are measured on cycles or how many cycles it can complete over its lifetime. That's one way to quantify the value.
Mm-hmm. And so what we need to do is to have the storage be more effective, we have to be able to have the technologies tolerate many, 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 many more cycles than they do now.
Yeah, and it's especially important when you think about the grid because, you know, our grid infrastructure, these are, you know, hard poles and wires, other assets that sit on the ground and are useful for on the order of decades, right? So in an ideal world, you would want the energy storage systems that we use to match up with the lifetime of all the other assets on our grid.
Right. So what you're saying is combining, and I want to get into some of the case studies of this a little bit too, but just to close the loop very quickly, what you're saying is if we combine, in effect, battery technologies with the ultracapacitors, we're getting a smoother delivery of electricity, maybe electrons is even more specific, through more sources over more time consistently. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially what we call it in the energy storage for the utility market is stacking services or increasing the number of value streams from the energy storage system, right? You want to be able to use that system. You've paid some money for it. You want to be able to use that system in as many different ways as possible.
Okay. So before we get too far into the weeds here and put people to sleep, talk about, you know, you mentioned the utilities. The business models for utilities has to change in order for all of this to work, too. We're looking at new sources of fuel. We're looking at a new way of delivering the fuel. We're looking at houses and cars that now have regeneration capacity. You know, the whole paradigm has shifted. So how do you see the business model for the utilities evolving? You know, what is it going to look like maybe in 10 years?
Yeah, it's certainly evolving. I think, you know, it's an interesting time in the landscape in that, you know, utilities are still very much in an exploratory phase with energy storage, really quantifying where does the energy storage need to be located on the grid? What kind of services can it provide? What's the long-term track record that we can establish for these kind of systems? You know, what's the realistic lifetime? There is an incredible amount of work being done at the policy level, as well as the utility level to enable energy storage onto the grid. So that's certainly changing. I think over time, you know, I think we're going to shift toward a distributed energy storage model, whereas, you know, in today's fossil fuel world, power generation is very centralized, where when you think about renewable solar, wind, those are going to be on sites located where it makes sense to put those solar and wind farms. And the storage can be located with those solar and wind farms. So it's a much more distributed model versus what we see today, and, you know, as a centralized power production.
Mm-hmm.
And utilities have to accommodate that, and they're looking into it, and they are. We're making some strong progress.
Well, what's interesting is Moore's Law, right? Technology evolves, in effect, at the speed of light. And by the time they figure out what this paradigm is going to look like, it's probably going to be a whole different paradigm. And yet these systems are extremely capital intensive. And so how do they decide what to invest in now when it's going to change in 10 years? I mean, the technology that they're considering now, you know, is probably going to be obsolete by the time they actually get a new infrastructure built.
Yeah, so I think the key around that piece right now is the flexibility of you know, say the storage piece. I mean, just like anything else, yeah, technology gets outmoded, you know, relatively quickly. So, you know, going back to this, being able to do more than one thing with your energy storage system is important. So the needs that energy storage system provides today is one matter, but it may need to provide a different set of needs tomorrow. So having that ability to control the system and essentially modify the way it works is critical, because we know that the story is going to change. You know, our grid is going to evolve. And, you know, over time, as technology improves, really what drives this is reduction in cost. So that's on that front, you know, we can proliferate energy storage more because the technology is going to enable cost reductions, both from an upfront cost perspective and an operating cost perspective.
So what happens to the grid when electric vehicles are a sizable share of cars on the road? I mean, today they're only a fraction.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, you know, electricity demand globally is going up and it will continue to rise. We need an EV infrastructure, EV charging infrastructure. And I think we're only at the cusp of putting that into place. But, you know, that's another huge reason why storage is going to be important, right? We're going to need some of these different rapid charging technologies, you know, spread out across the world to be able to accommodate all of the EVs, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this. So thank you for bringing that up, because President Obama and the automakers recently launched initiatives to massively expand the infrastructure for electric vehicles. The goal, of course, is to be able to charge your vehicle as easily as it is to fill up at a gas station right now. Yet all EVs don't even use the same plug configuration or the same batteries, among other variables. So, and we don't even know, you know, so many of them are dominated by lithium ion technologies, but we don't even know if lithium ion is going to be the battery of tomorrow, right? So how do you build an infrastructure for electric vehicles that has longevity when the technology is evolving so quickly, we don't even necessarily know which technology to put into it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's a great point, and it's a chicken and egg problem. Mm-hmm. And we saw this in the world of fuel cells many years back. You know, do I put the refilling or charging infrastructure in place in anticipation of demand, or vice versa? Right. So that's a key problem. And in terms of technology deployment, what it really takes is the pioneers of the industry basically drawing a line on the sand and saying we have to start somewhere. We are making our best, most educated estimate at what technologies are going to be the most relevant. And we're going to run pilot programs. That's the way it starts. And I think once we have firm deployments, I would say core reference projects at different EV charging stations and how these different storage technologies are performing, it's going to be refined and optimized from there. It's a matter of really just putting a stake in the ground, knowing the landscape is going to change.
Which is really what Elon...
We have a lot to learn about how these systems operate and perform over time. Really from the automaker's perspective, there has to be some consolidation around standards, I think, to really... propagate uniformity and promote an EV charging infrastructure.
So in effect, the technologies that Elon Musk is developing in the new plant that he's building in Nevada and the batteries that will come out of that will, in effect, to use your words, be a line in the sand of saying, okay, we're gonna hitch our boat to this technology for now, knowing that tomorrow we might have to shift.
Yeah. At some point, you've got to make a bet. You've got to place your bet, right?
Right.
And he's certainly done that. And it's a launching point.
So all of this being said, what do you think will be the impact of the new administration's pro-fossil fuel, in effect, anti-renewable energy policies and even rhetoric, frankly? I mean, he can't undo the appropriations bill that was passed in Congress with the wind production tax credit. And he can't stop the private sector from all the investments in clean energy that they've already made and committed to. And private capital is going in from venture capital and private equity, et cetera. So what can the impact be in the worst case scenario?
Yeah, so I am an optimist, and I will always be an optimist. And, your second point that you hit on, looking at the private investment community, non-government funding has already invested a substantial amount of money in renewables and energy storage and infrastructure. I think we've passed that tipping point where we were fully reliant on government subsidies and programs to support the industry. I think that train has left the station. So, while the current administration is certainly more pro-fossil fuel, there's too many brilliant people working on renewables, and there's too much money being poured in it from non-government sources. It's going to go no matter what, and it's going to come down to economics, right? If there's some tipping point where fossil fuel generation becomes far, far, far cheaper than renewables, that's going to drive it. But at this point, I don't see that happening based on the momentum of the renewables, at least in the U.S.
Well, that's interesting because a lot of the argument of ARPA-E, which, of course, is quite young but has had a dramatic impact, is that the role of government is to reduce the technical risk on early stage energy technologies for private capital to then step in. Now, they've had tremendous success with that business model. They've had about $1.5 billion of additional private capital flow into the technologies that they've invested in with government funding, which is a terrific ROI. So that's the opposite of what you're saying. I mean, they're believing that it is government's role to remove the technical risk, and there is a role for government to be there. But it sounds like what you're saying is, you know, private capital can even invest at that early stage too.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, if there's business justification there, if the business models are in place, which they are and are only growing stronger for renewables and storage. We don't need so much benefits from government support. Now, if you're talking about the earliest stages, fundamental technology, super high risk, years and years away from a commercial deployment, yes, there is potential that that some of those technologies may suffer some delay. But once again, you know, if there's driving force from the private landscape, we'll find a way.
So that's the energy R&D, really, that you're talking about, that somebody else is going to have to pick up the slack from if they're not doing it. Well, many of the states are very committed to renewable energy. Some even passed ballot measures in the same election that elected Donald Trump. So and many of them have renewable energy standards. Many of, you know, a recent Solar Foundation study found that every state but one that voted for Trump actually added a significant number of solar jobs, for example, and some states even doubling the number of solar jobs. So, you know, can the states fill in this gap?
There's a lot of potential for that, you know, and there's certainly more progressive states like the one I'm sitting in right here in California that absolutely are committed, regardless of you know, certain federal policies, and are going to do whatever they can, whatever is allowable to continue to move on the right technology trajectory for these markets.
Cool. What about hydropower? We haven't really talked about hydropower.
Yeah. So hydropower is a key part of the energy generation and in some of the energy storage toolbox. The interesting thing about hydropower is it's very geography dependent, right? So there's going to be certain areas where it makes perfect sense to focus on hydropower and use hydropower as the dominant source of electricity. And, you know, in those regions, the need for storage and the need for other technologies is very different from a place in the middle of the Arizona desert, right? So, like I said, in this distributed energy storage or distributed energy model, it's very geography dependent. You capitalize on what's around you. So hydropower is a great technology, and it makes perfect sense in some places.
Mm-hmm. So I want to get to a couple things. I want to ask you a couple questions about you. You know, a lot of our audience are business decision makers who have to figure out what energy and power sourcing to put into operations and plants and even shopping malls and airports that they're building now or they're renovating now. And obviously, these require years and years of advanced planning and very capital intensive. But by the time they're built, new technologies are going to be out there. We may even have a brand new grid by then. So how do you advise business leaders to make decisions about what kind of structure to put in their new buildings to accommodate these changes in where they're going to get the power to run those buildings and those plants and those airports?
Yeah, like I said, there's key metrics. There's an ROI on these energy storage systems, right? And in light of the fact that the grid is going to change, you have to conceive of an energy storage system that is flexible, right? So I can use it for one purpose one day, and then I can repurpose it to do something else the next day. And when you think about the different types of storage technologies, you talked about combining storage technologies together. There's multiple benefits to doing that, in that there's the opportunity to not only decrease the upfront capital cost, there's opportunity to decrease the operating cost, which I think is going to come under more and more focus as these systems demonstrate their utility. You know, perhaps we projected a lifetime of 10 years on a particular battery chemistry doing a certain thing, and it turns out it only works for 3 years before it needs to be replaced. So combination of the appropriate technologies and ability to use the system in multiple ways are going to be keys to building those financial models appropriately and presenting a justifiable business case.
Cool. That's very helpful. What do you say to people in coal country, many of whom voted for the new president when he committed to bringing coal jobs back? You know, the data shows that, in my view, coal is not coming back. Many of these companies have gone bankrupt. The economics of even natural gas as well as renewables have really kind of priced coal out of the market. Besides, of course, you have the public health issues that can't be denied. But a lot of these people, well, you know, they want their old job back. What do you tell those people?
Yes, it's an entirely understandable position when you've been doing something, you know, for an entire career. My general personal sentiment is it's 2017. We need to move on as a civilization. And coal while, you know, drove this nation and drove the world, and is still driving many parts of the world, got us to a certain place, but we've evolved. We've evolved past it. It's a challenge because it requires new skills, requires us to keep our minds open and learn about new technologies to do our jobs. But simply, we have to move on.
Okay, that's fair. So I want to talk about you for a moment before I let you go. You got into energy storage before it was a household word. How did you decide to take up the career that you've taken up?
Oh, well, yeah, so I've always been fascinated with electrochemistry, which is the foundation of energy storage. What first sucked me into this was actually a problem that the military was having, specifically our warfighters. Our warfighters carry around anywhere from, 20 to 40 pounds of batteries with them when they go out on multi-day missions. They carry that on their backs, and they walk many, many, many miles. And so I'm thinking about this, how can we decrease the size and weight of these batteries that they carry around for all their communications equipment? So that they have to carry around less. Their jobs are hard enough already. They don't need this. So it was a very, very practical consideration that I started with that got me fascinated with the problems of energy storage. My roots are in entrepreneurship. I love it. I have a passion for it. And in working with startups and small companies, it had always fascinated me on how to translate the technical characteristics to dollars. So I wanted to turn watts to dollars, and going back and getting a business degree and keeping that balance, I think it's a nice bridge. And there's a place for folks who can extract technology information and really turn it into concise information for the business community, so they can make educated decisions.
Cool. I like that. So, tell us about a moment in your career, maybe mid-career, when you had to make a critical decision that in retrospect seems like a turning point, and what it was, how you made that decision, and how you feel about it now.
Oh, wow. That's a big one. I would say, probably the biggest decisions are kind of what we talked about a moment ago, is placing bets. Right. There was a point in my career when I had to pick a certain storage technology to utilize for a project. And as with most emerging technologies and unproven technologies, you don't have the benefit of having a complete picture to make decisions on. You don't have all of the information you need. And ultimately, you just have to make a decision. And all you can do is break the problem down into its smallest components. Analyze as much as you can and make a decision. Having the benefit of hindsight now, would I probably have made some different decisions on selection of certain technologies that I thought would really ultimately succeed in the market? Yes, absolutely. I would probably give the best advice is look at where the investment and the money is going, and not necessarily where government money is going, but where the venture community is going with their money, because at the end of the day, it's a race, right? And in general, if you have a large portion of the market throwing dollars behind a certain technology, that technology is generally going to be developed faster than other technologies. And so once that momentum is built, it's got a much greater chance of going to the market, right? So even though some technologies may look better on paper, they may be more ideal. They may not get to market as quickly.
So what would you suggest to a woman out of college or maybe mid-career who wants to use her education to make a difference in the energy field, especially since it's still so dominated by white men? I mean, I love these guys, but, we need more diversity. Would you tell them to make a bet?
Yeah, this is what I tell anyone, man, woman, follow your passion, follow what you believe in. We spend so much of our lives working. You may as well spend that time doing something that you're truly passionate about. you know, for a woman mid-career, with respect to renewables and energy storage, there is so much opportunity out there. You could consider going into policy. There is ample opportunity right now to have a voice and be a key influencer and decision maker on the direction of where these storage technologies are going, where renewables are going. So that's one side of it. If you want to go top down to influence the market and then have an impact, there's huge opportunities in business. Taking those technologies and bringing them to the market and building the business cases. So I would say if there's someone who has a strong technical foundation but has always been fascinated in the business aspects, yes, absolutely. Jump in with both feet onto the business side. Learn about the key metrics and the key drivers to take these technologies out of their nascent stage and go down that road.
Perfect. That's a terrific sentiment to end on. Thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio, Dr. Kimberly McGrath of Maxwell Technologies. We will link to her site from our website as well. So what did you hear Kimberly say? What storage technologies do you prefer? If you have a preference, how would you like us to look at it? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it to us on our Facebook page and like the page while you're there. And ask to join our new private Facebook group, too. Or email it to us at info@greenconnectionsradio.com. You can also leave it on iTunes with your review. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Hi, my name is David Goldberg, president of Edge Studio, a voiceover company. We oversee professional narrators and voice actors for sales videos, training videos, telephone pre-recorded systems, commercials, web videos, and all applications requiring voiceover. And in fact, for over 20 years and in over 100 languages, we have been considered the most trusted and the friendliest leader in the voiceover industry. We're a green company with efforts toward sustainability at all of our studio locations. EdgeStudio.com. Sound people who are happy to help.